and welcome to Unjustly Maligned, the show for people who go against the grain. We seek to rehabilitate the overlooked, ignored, derided, or the just plain hated. Movies, novels, music, comic books, video games, whatever. If everyone hates it, we'll find someone who loves it and let them explain why you should too. I'm your host, Anthony Johnston, and my guest today is the writer, podcaster, and incessant Twitter machine, Glenn Fleischman. Glenn, welcome to the show.
Hello. You forgot to mention part-time raccoon, but that requires yes. more explanation.
Yes, your love of raccoons precedes you, sir. All right. So this episode is one of our more esoteric subjects, shall we say, but it is a subject that I don't often get to talk about with other people for reasons that will probably become apparent during the show. So I was kind of delighted, actually, when you suggested this as a topic. So please tell us what you have come on the show to talk about and then give us some context around its place in popular culture, why it is maligned and why you think that that is wrong.
Well, I've come to talk about the difficult topic of difficult music. And it's something that's been close to my heart for decades. I wouldn't say I discovered it, maybe not as an early teen, but as I got into my teenage years, I found an incredible resonance with music that other people, it's not that they disliked, but avoided. So my definition of difficult music is music that is not intended to be listened to passively. It can be anti-melodic, it can be dissonant, it can be intentionally awful. Like, it can be the kind of thing that the composer or practitioners set out to make hard to listen to, and the motivation for it is not to be unpleasant. I mean, this is different from, say, bad pop music, which is difficult to listen right. to because it's bad.
It's just bad.
It's just bad. No one wants to listen to that. This is music that is designed to elicit a certain kind of intellectual response or even an emotional response. I think often there's an intellectual component to it because you have to listen to it. It demands you pay attention. If you don't, it may simply sound like irritating background noise or be completely banal to you. So difficult music is something it's like a music weapon. Like, it's designed to penetrate our normal defenses and get inside to then explode and make us think about things differently. And I would say the point of most music in popular culture, whether it's, and whatever extreme it is, whether it's classical or pop or rock or country or Celtic or whatever the genre is, a lot of that music isn't designed to necessarily please per se. You know, I'll give the benefit of the doubt to, you know, all creators who aren't seeking specifically to create a pop hit that has to have a certain kind of a pleasure response in order to go, platinum or whatever the equivalent is today. It goes lightly bronze. It's music that composers are trying to elicit an emotional response. That's the point of music, I think, is to talk in a different language than the spoken word to people and play on their heartstrings. And I think difficult music goes a level further where it says, I'm not just trying to use this sonic reference frame to make you feel happy or sad or even convey a complex set of overlapping emotions. I actually want to break our deal and use music to poke into parts of your head that you don't necessarily want me to, but you're giving me permission to because I'm helping you think about the world in a different way.
That's a really good way of putting it. thank you for that summary. Yeah, it's you're right that there's often an intellectual aspect to it, because there's very much a connection and a lot of crossover between the sort of music we're talking about and works of art and performance art especially. But one thing I want to just mention is that you mentioned that, like, people aren't seeking pop hits when they make a lot of this kind of music, but occasionally it still happens, which is one of the things that I find most interesting. Like, the perfect example over here, I'm not so sure about in the States, actually, but certainly over here, the perfect example is Laurie Anderson's Oh Superman.
Hello? Is anybody home? Well, you don't know me, but I know you. To give to you, here come the plane. you better get ready. Ready to go. You can come as you are. The pay as you go. Pay as you go.
Oh, yeah, actually, that's been popular. That has gotten on the charts, I think, here. And you hear it from time to time, too.
Well, it was number two in the pop charts over here for several weeks, as I recall. I was very young. This was 1981, I want to say.
Amazing.
So it was a long time ago. And that really was my first exposure to anything that wasn't just sort of regular pop or rock music. This was post my introduction to heavy rock and heavy metal, thanks to my father, at a very young age. But it was certainly before I had discovered things like progressive rock. And the idea that this somehow was music, I remember my parents being baffled. I remember most people being baffled by it, to be perfectly honest. But I liked it. I actively liked it. I liked the fact that it was really long as well, which has been become a lifelong. Anybody who listens to me talk about music on various podcasts will know, you know, I'm a big fan of long pieces. And so at a really early age, the idea that you could do something like this and have a sort of accidental pop hit, you know, kind of enter my country. If I'm honest, I think it kind of broke me in a way, because a lot of this stuff I listen to now, part of the reason that I like listening to a lot of this stuff is that I actually don't find a lot of it difficult to listen to. You get some stuff like Lou Reed's Metal Machine Music. Which is just feedback. I mean, it's literally, it's an hour of feedback. That is very difficult to listen to. Or Sun-O, or well, they're actually officially just called Sun. It's a matter of argument amongst their fans. but they do the same sort of thing, but with like really, really deep and resonant down-tuned guitars and bass with no percussion. Almost no rhythm, so it's just sort of waves of really bass heavy sound. And you know, they're a band that you really have to see live to appreciate more than on record. And again, that is genuinely difficult to listen to because it's just sort of waves of sound, of noise, which is of course, you know, something that people often level against difficult music. Say, oh, it's just noise.
I have a wonderful anecdote about that, though, that it completely supports your point. Is, you know, every generation says to the next generation's music, it just sounds like noise to us, right? I'm in an Urban Outfitter to get a gift card or something for a cousin, young cousin, with my wife several years ago, and we're walking around, and the sound system starts to go, and I'm like, you know, I'm as much of a fan of difficult music as not the next person, but I can't figure this out. It's just, I finally go up to one of the salespeople and I said, is something wrong with the sound system or is this music? And the person says, oh, this is music. And I was like, okay. And then eventually, after what seemed like minutes to me, it started to settle into like, it was techno, but I'd never heard techno with as like long an intro before.
Right.
Like that. And I was like, okay, I've hit that point. And the inflection is like 35. I'm like, all right, it sounds like it is literally noise to me, but I'm like, oh my gosh, is that what Frank Sinatra sounded like to people who were, you know, 50 years old in 1945? I don't know. It's very funny.
Well, and a similar thing happened not so long ago with the popularization of dubstep.
Which,
you know, and I've actually gotten to like quite a bit of dubstep, but I freely admit that I'm a very casual dubstep listener, and I listen to the sort of stuff that gets uploaded to YouTube or played on the radio, not the real hardcore stuff, just because I don't know even begin where to go looking for it. But that has the same thing, and before that we had drum and bass and jungle.
Oh, yeah.
Which I remember one of my friends, I think he may have been quoting from a music review paper, but he described jungle as the sound of somebody throwing a box of cutlery down the stairs.
D&B is still big too. I have friends on Twitter who are, there's a huge D&B scene in New York, and people are all over that.
Well, and techno ambient is still a big thing. And that actually
never goes away.
Well, but that actually does tie into something else you said, which is the whole business of demanding attention, because there is a difference that we need to draw between what we're talking about, this sort of difficult music, and just purely sort of ambient music, which has a lot of the same, people say the same things. They say, oh, it's not really music, it's just a collection of sounds stretched out for 3 hours, you know, whatever, it's boring. You know, the sort of stuff that Brian Eno famously does with his generative pieces quite often. But, you know, he's by far not the only person doing that, and hasn't been for many years now. But the difference is that Eno always defined that sort of music, his discrete music, as he first called it, as you could pay attention to it, or you could just have it on in the background and pay no attention to it, and you'd get equal value from both.
Thank you.
Well, in some cases, the music is trying to program your brain in a certain way. Like, that's one of the great things about even if it's dissonant, but like the sounds or loud, repetitive, undulating sounds or whatever that is, it will get everyone into the same groove, right?
So right.
For a dance scene or even a rave or any kind of, you know, group activity, I think that kind of music is, it's like a phase music. It puts you all in the same place, even if it's not considered beautiful or pretty or danceable or whatever, as long as there's a beat or a recurrent pattern or something that gets everyone into the same mode. That's not difficult per se. It may be difficult to listen to, but it's not difficult music
because its
intention is to, create a group space as opposed to create individual thinking and dissonance in your brain. I mean, I think difficult music creates cognitive dissonance. That's it. Even if the music isn't dissonant itself, it's trying to create a tension that you have to resolve. I tell jokes on Twitter where I just state the premise and I'm like, you finish the joke. And then some people will be like, wait, like, oh, and it's worse. Because they have to finish the joke in their head. I made them create the joke in their space. And that's worse than me telling the pun.
It is. And you're right, because the sort of music that you're describing there, I mean, lots of extreme heavy metal, for example, could, you know, will happily fall into that space of, it's not intentionally sort of, I mean, it's exclusionary, but it's not difficult in the sense that we talk of it. Because as you say, yes, it's trying to create a group space, an almost tribal space in the case of a lot of extreme metal. And I do listen to a lot of that stuff. And I would never describe that as difficult music. I would never put that in the same realm as someone like Stockhausen or Steve Reich or even Philip Glass, because, you know, that's not the intention and it's not the style. And if you are into that sort of music, if you find those collections of down-tuned guitars, thrashing drums and grunted vocals pleasing, then you will actively like that music, you know, as I do. Which brings us to, actually, I was going to mention percussion.
Mm.
Or rather, rhythm. And rhythm is something that separates, for me anyway, a lot of difficult from non-difficult music. Like, for example, again, Lou Reed's Metal Machine Music or Sun O's output, there is no rhythm.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's no percussion in those, but even more than percussion, there's literally just no, even without percussion, you can still have rhythm in the way the instruments are played or the way the sounds are produced, and there is no rhythm. And that's clearly, you know, a very deliberate choice, as opposed to, again, a lot of Eno's work. Laurie Anderson's, you know, lots of Laurie Anderson's output has a rhythm, and I actually find it very, very pleasing, even when it might be sonically dissonant, because I find the rhythm sort of draws me along, even if it's an odd time signature or something. But then you get something like Mikrofoni Ein, a mixture from Stockhausen. Which have lots of percussion, but they have almost no rhythm whatsoever. I mean, Mikrofoni Ein, particularly, is literally just, you know, guys rubbing things against other things. there's not even an attempt at making a rhythm. And that, I think, is one of the big divisive factors between difficult and non-difficult music, in the sense that you're talking about it.
Yeah, that's really great. I mean, there's all these different aspects. You could talk about rhythm or lack of rhythm. There's atonality. There's, a dissonance. There's, what do you call, almost breaking the rhythm. So That's something I'll bring up, Bertolt Brecht and Kurt Weill. Of course, Kurt Weill was the composer, but Brecht and Weill had an amazing collaboration. And even though some of their music is popular from some musicals, and some of the musicals are produced a lot too, there's something about it. It's so subversive that if you're not listening, it's less difficult than some because you can listen to it. I bring up Elvis Costello as this example too. When Veronica hit the charts in America, I'm driving around, my sister turns on the radio and they're playing Veronica. I'm like, why are they playing this song on pop radio? She's like, it's great. I thought, this is a song about, you know, someone in a elderly home who's lost her memory and is being sort of slightly mistreated by the staff. And you know, it's like, how is, and like, oh, no one's listening to the words. Right. I understand. And, you know,
the Bruce Springsteen effect.
Exactly. Glory Days. Wait a minute. Glory Days isn't really about your glory day. Okay. Well, yeah. We'll move on there. But I think that's, so Brecht and Weill, one of the things is they're jogging along on a rhythm, and then Weill with Brecht together, with Brecht's kind of, the way in which the lyrics break against the repetition of the melody. Is a characteristic thing. You're singing against the melody. It's not antiphonic. Although actually I like Kaycock singing. It's a Balinese, modern Balinese singing. It was actually almost invented for a movie in the 1930s, the sidebar, but it has that, antiphony. Back and forth, different teams of people chanting it back and forth, handing the rhythm back and forth. And that's not per se difficult. You know, it's just, it's complicated. But in Brecht and Weill, you've got a singer has to sing listening to the melody with one hand, but working against it as like a counter theme to the other. And if you don't do that, it sounds pretty, but it's not that great. If you do it correctly, it becomes more difficult because the listener is hearing that, you know, perfectly timed on ba 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 ba, and someone's going da 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 on top of it. You're like, wait, okay, those things are not aligned. So what does that mean? It makes you hear the words in a way you wouldn't if everything were perfectly synchronized or perfectly in alignment, I guess.
It's almost like an operatic version of Steve Reich's phase pieces.
Yeah, I was going to bring up piano phase. This is my, I mean, that's the thing. If this is one of the things why I want to talk about difficult music, because I want to introduce people to it. I want people to go out and seek it out, because it's, if it's been around the edges of your knowledge and interest and you've never kind of pushed out that way, piano phase, I think, is one of the most remarkable things.
Thank you.
played it for my children who are 9 and 11. I played a bit of it the other day and they actually tolerated it pretty well. But it's the concept is, Reich or Reich, I never remember how to pronounce his name. People need a pronunciation guide for him, but it's, it's a simple method. I forget how many bars. It's like just a few bars. And you have two pianists who are sitting typically at, facing each other. And they move gradually out of phase for, how long is it? 18 minutes, I think. And then back in phase. And it's the same thing they're playing this entire time. And the melodies that rise and where things hit, it's extraordinary. And you can't not listen to it. It's hard because you're hearing two different phases simultaneously. So you're hearing, and it requires incredible, dexterity and skill. You have to be a virtuoso to play this thing because they're moving gradually one bar. I think it's one entire bar out of phase and back over this period of time. And it has to be done so perfectly and gradually that these new rhythms, melodies rise out of it. But two people playing slightly offset is very difficult to listen to because your brain is trying to construct it into the pattern it believes it should be. Instead, it's constructing an entire new set of music out of hearing those interstices. And
yeah,
it can be painful almost unless you're in the right mood or mode. To quote Laurie Anderson, there's a great bit from one of her albums where she says, I was on a plane. She's using her vocoder. I was on a plane. I was sitting next to a girl and she was so digital. Everything for her was either on or off. And something about like her boyfriend wasn't moody. He was modey. This is from the 80s and she captured kind of an entire culture that was incipient and coming into being. But I still come back to that as, yeah, he was modey.
the gradual movement, I mean, certainly for the players, that's got to be the most difficult part of piano phase, certainly, yeah. But also, it brings about, when I listen to it, because what you get, because there are, I think there's eight notes, I think it's two bars of four notes each.
That's right. It's just so repeated, simple. Yeah.
And what they, as you say, they alter play the timing of their playing ever so slightly, and they add and subtract the occasional note along the way. And I think that's something that's left up to the players, if I recall correctly. That's not written in, or rather not written in stone, but the fact that they can do that is part of the composition. What you get as a result is they start in complete sync. And as you say, it's like, you know, eight notes repeated over and over, and they start in complete sync. Then they start to go out and it gets like, oh, you're like, oh, this isn't good, you know. And then they'll get just enough out of sync that they're maybe a quarter beat out. And suddenly that sounds quite nice because then it sounds like an arpeggiated chord or something. But then they'll shift out again and then it gets hard to listen to again. And then they'll get a half beat out. And oh, actually, that's quite nice. Well, that sounds
exactly
good. And so you get these waves of the every so often it'll sort of drop in, for want of a better phrase, to a rhythm, and you'll be like, oh, that's quite nice actually. And those are the times when the traditionalist in me is dying for a bass chord. Do you know what I'm dying for? Somebody to go dum on the bottom end of the piano or something and bring it all into a song. But of course it's not a song, it's a piece, it's a work of art and a performance.
Well, have you heard Different Trains, which is also Stephen Reich, and is performed by Pat Metheny? And that one is interesting because it does bring in bass, and it's a similar, well, I don't want to say it's gosh, I'm making a mistake. Different Trains, it's on an album with Pat Metheny's on it, and it's a Cronus Quartet. I'm sorry, that performs it. And it's a string quartet plus tape. And that album, I'm trying to think of the other material on it, but that has that a similar feel. It's more complicated in the sense that there's more notes. It's not the same precise thing, but it's also it has more of that deeper tone because it's not just piano. You've got, you know, four string instruments there, and he's got tape loops that are happening as well.
Is it more difficult to do when there are more notes, though? Because one of the things whenever I see a video of people, and there's one particular video that always comes up first on YouTube of people playing piano phase, the thing that strikes me is the incredible patience and discipline required on the part of the players to keep playing those notes at that time, in that rhythm, in that way. Yes. Just, it's like, here's one for the sort of geeky part of the audience. Have you ever done one of those things in a text editor where you're editing a piece of text on your computer and you get into the rhythm of, you know, hitting a couple of arrow keys and then a modifier key and, you know, a number or something. And you're just going down the lines, applying the same change to every line in the piece. Maybe that's just me that does that. I don't know.
Oh, I know that. Yeah, that's.
But you get into that rhythm, don't you? With the keys, you get into that rhythm and it almost becomes like a piece of rhythmic, almost music in and of itself. But the thing about that that always strikes me is whenever I do that, you can guarantee after about 30 or 40 instances, I will lose it. Something will go wrong and I'll get out of rhythm with myself. And so, I mean, you know, this is a world away from playing piano, obviously, but the principle is kind of the same. And so, yeah, whenever I see people doing that sort of thing on the piano, I think, or, well, any instrument, I think the incredible amount of discipline required to play that, I think, is sometimes overlooked by, especially by detractors of this kind of music, of which obviously there are many.
It can seem simple. I mean, that's Stephen Reich in particular. And I guess you'd also say Philip Glass, although I think Philip Glass's minimalist compositions tend to sound more complicated. And Stephen Reich, like, once you look at, we'll do real time correction. It's supposed to last about 15 minutes. So they go in and out of phase over about 7.5 minutes and back in. And you're right. I think of it as having one set of, it's like one bar of 12 notes, but it's multiple sections, but they're playing almost identical notes. They drop some out in the second section, and then they play a smaller version, only four notes in the third section. But it's not new music. So it's a variation on the same initial section that he has the players play. It's very interesting. But yeah, it's sound, because, you know, you say to somebody, well, the pianists just have to play the same notes over and over again, and they play them fairly rapidly. You're like, oh, well, that doesn't sound that complicated. That sounds like a discipline and practice issue. It's like, yes, but now they both have to listen. They have to play on a perfect tempo, and pianists who are very good play, you know, obviously learn to play on a strict tempo in their mind. But then they have to be able to play off this other person who's moving, you know, fractions of a note off, and then back in. I have no idea how, every time I hear it, I have no idea how someone is capable of having the musicality to do that. And I've heard a number of recordings, because it's definitely something people like to do for recitals. So,
oh, I'll bet.
Challenge ourselves. And there's some great, clearly like student, maybe a graduate music student, or other professionals doing it. So there's, you know, the classic recordings that Reich has made, and then other people trying it. I think it's quite wonderful. It's quite wonderful that people will put themselves to that task too.
Absolutely. Well, because we have, and this speaks to why a lot of this music is considered difficult to listen to. We have an innate tendency, an innate desire as humans to sort of get into the rhythm with a group, or the notes with a group. You know, we do this all the time, and musicians do it obviously when they're jamming. You know, get a group of musicians together, eventually they'll all start jamming the blues. I mean, that's what happens. And especially if there's a guitarist in the bunch. And that's our natural tendency. And even take away the sort of professional instruments and just have people banging on rocks for rhythm, people will eventually get into the same rhythm. They will join together. They will, you know, try and sort of be complementary, rather than being ever so slightly out of time and then maintaining that being ever so slightly out of time for the next like 90 seconds while the other person is in a different, and you're just like, that is so hard. It's so, requires such a degree of conscious effort. It's amazing, as you say.
Well, and this is, I think, gets us back to the heart of what difficult music is it requires this intentionality, that it's the easiest thing in the world to play something with melodically. And I don't mean that to the detriment of any musician, but more like...
No, but that is our human instinct, isn't it?
Yeah, everything we do is in a melody or a rhythm. And different cultures express that in different ways at different times. There's, you know, in some cultures there are things that sound to us in, some Eastern music to people in the West sounds dissonant, but it's actually just a different chromatic scale or different structure, but it's completely self-consistent and it is also rhythmic. And likewise, people in the East, until the America took over the world, with all of its tastes, Western music would sound unpalatable and probably oversimplistic or unharmonious to many people, in many different cultures, in Asia. So, I'm fascinated. See, and I think piano play is an interesting piece because it requires both the performer to maintain this state of dissonance as well, cognitive dissonance, as well as for the listener to be absorbed in it. It's a collaboration. In that both parties have to participate in order to achieve this new state. Not all difficult music is like that. I think in some cases, it's not as much of a challenge for the musician. The composition and the preparation and the discipline is there, but I don't think it's as hard an act for the musician to maintain the balance that the listener has to maintain in hearing it. It's an asymmetrical process. So here's a good example. John Zorn, before he went very religious and composed Masada and kind of got out of his avant-garde roots, I heard him perform. He's a saxophonist, and I used to subscribe many years ago. I had a roommate. He and I paid for this thing called Ear, I think it was, and every month they would send us a CD of just wild stuff. It was really interesting, and it pushed the limits of my knowledge when I was in my early 20s of music at a time. This is in the dark days when it was hard to get anything but mainstream CDs. You'd have to go to specialty stores, and you could pay like $30 for a CD instead of 12 or something to get something neat or an import. And so they would send us a disc, and we'd just be like, oh. And when he and I moved out of the same place, we like actually split up our Ear CDs among each other. Like, do you like? Yeah, okay, let's keep this so we can keep hearing it. And John Zorn somehow entered my consciousness back around then, almost 30 years ago. And I was visiting this roommate in California, and he's like, John Zorn's performing. I'm like, oh, let's go hear him. This tiny, weird venue. We were on risers or chairs. Maybe there were 30 people in the place. I had a splitting headache, and I got to listen to him perform for a couple hours. And it's one of the greatest musical experiences of my life because – even though I was in pain, it was very difficult. I was in anguish, listening, but he's playing all these loud things, but he's making a saxophone do things the saxophone wasn't designed to do. He's pushing the limits of the form, and he's conveying all this meaning and emotion and so forth, but it's not exactly music. I mean, it's not music as people had classically defined it. That was terrific. And I feel like that in that case, it may have been easier for someone like John Zorn to express his musical nature through what I would find is difficult, what was challenging for me to listen to, but not necessarily challenging for him to express himself that way. The actual technical challenge was high because of what he was making the instrument do, but it wasn't like a piano phase in which he's locked in this extremely difficult puzzle. He is doing the thing he wants to do with an instrument that he is bringing other people to have to come along with him on his journey.
Right, right. Which is kind of, I mean, that's not dissimilar to jazz, really.
That's true. No, it's true.
In terms of its outlook, yeah, I mean, which I'm not actually a big fan of, I must admit, but it sounds like a similar sort of approach, yeah, where he is going on instinct from the heart, playing what he wants to, and the result may not be that easy for you to listen to, but it's not the same, not for the same reasons as, the sort of the very technical, intellectual approach to a lot of the difficult music that we've been talking about.
Well, like in one case, it's, music that I would say is not difficult. It's like it conveys the emotion of being happy, right? Music that is difficult maybe conveys the notion of how to build an alternating current power plant. It's just like there's, it's not even, I don't want to, this is again, I don't want to go and say, there's plenty of music that is mainstream and people, a large swaths of people like, and there's nothing uncomplicated about it. And someone like Roseanne Cash, you know, I don't love all country music. There are many segments of it that really speak to me. And like Willie Nelson, Roseanne Cash, several other performers, there's something about their particular style, maybe honky tonk more than, you know, the contemporary country is better. And you listen, and she is playing the strings of my heart, right? She is knows exactly to bring me up and down, and taking with it. There's no pebulum about it. It's or nothing saccharine. She knows how to speak truthfully, and so you know she is a great exemplar. Or Elvis Costello, even though I was saying he's difficult in some ways, like he's a mainstream musician in a lot of ways, and there is nothing simple about what he is doing to my emotional state. But it is, again, as if they are bringing me along a journey that they have gone through, and they're recounting a journey to me that they can take me along. Difficult music is, you know, I have to build the ship to ride that sea. They don't give me a boat to get in.
Right. It's incomplete.
Yeah.
Incomplete by design. They're giving you, well, again,
yeah,
like a good work of art. They're presenting you with something with the intention of you completing it, of making you think,
that's it.
What does this mean?
I have to, because, right, the journey for me is that I have to construct something, almost a new structure. This is why, okay, so I'll liken it to Neal Stephenson's Anathem book, which, I don't have you read that? A lot of people have.
I have not. I confess, I like Stephenson's writing, but so many of his books are just way too long for me.
I've not gotten through the Quicksilver trilogy or quadrology, whatever it is now, so I appreciate that. But Anthem, I think we may have read it for an Incomparable episode. I picked it up, and the first time through the book, he invents a lot of language, and that's not atypical in science fiction or fantasy.
Oh, sure, I've done that myself, yeah.
Yeah, and I'm like, all right, well, okay, I'll go through this, and I'm kind of coming along with him at this world building he's doing. And then somewhere in the book, I realize how much of a vocabulary and structure he's built in my head of a world, not just words. I get to the end and I'm like, holy cow, he rebuilt my brain. Like he actually changed the structures in my brain. And I read it again later and the book read entirely differently. Now reading a book a second time often produces a different reading.
Right.
In this case, he had built a scaffolding in my head almost without my permission, without me realizing I was doing it, so that the second reading was almost like a different book. And I feel like difficult music can do that. It sounds like noise often, or something unlistenable to originally, and then it builds itself a home in your head, so that when you hear it again, you see it evolves. I had a design teacher in Switzerland. I took a summer course there once. This woman, Dorothea Hoffman, she drew on paper. She drew these enormous, like sometimes 7 foot tall eggs with graphite. And it was just kind of a very interesting style she devolved into. And the thing is, you would look at it and you'd be like, this is just a bunch of lines. What is this? And as you're watching, your brain would construct it. And then suddenly it would go whoop. And you saw the egg almost three dimensionally on the page. And it wasn't magic eye drawings, but it was almost like a trick, because you didn't feel yourself consciously making a new construction in your head. It happened to you. And I think the best difficult music is what it does is you have to pay attention, but the musician is able to tap into deep structures that build themselves and then let you interpret the music. It's like booting up. Here's, you know, okay, we're going to boot up the computer. Here's a new language we're installing. Now we're going to restart and we're going to execute this program. You're like, okay, I'm going along for the ride.
I was going to agree, and I do agree largely with you, but I'm not so sure. I think specifically what you're talking about, yes, is, well, specific to difficult music. But the more I think about it, all music, all art, really, does that to you, I think. The first time you encounter something completely new, whether it's a new genre of music, whether it's a new style of art, whether it's, you know, a new performance or whatever, a new type of performance or style of performance or dance, the first time you see it, you are inevitably judging it only by things that are not it, because that's all you know. When you then encounter more things like it or experience it for a second or further time, then you've already had that initial shock of the new experience. And so you're instead comparing it to your prior experience. Now you have something to compare it against. But the first time that you encounter anything like that, you don't have any prior experience against which to measure it. And I think that's where the shock of the new comes from. I can think of many, many music genres, albums and stuff that I've heard that have done this to me. And they have rewired my brain and they have allowed me to then seek out other works similar to that. But it's not because they were difficult music or made with that intention necessarily. It's just because I had never encountered anything like that before. And so it takes time for your brain to figure out, okay, what is this for? What is this about? And can I use that as a baseline against which to judge other things in the same kind of milieu?
I think you're absolutely right. And I don't think I thought about it in that context. And it's true. And so there may be like a degree of difficulty, but I mean, this is when we talk about one generation, not understanding the next's music or artistic taste or writing or so forth is that, I mean, it's the case that, old people like me as I reaching 50, it's harder for us to like new things. I think that's a myth, but anyway, there's this notion that once, you know, you get into these deep grooves, these deep patterns and things that don't fall into them, and, you know, just, I mean, neurologically, it's harder for us to change because we have established these, you know, literally physical patterns in our brain that have to reform themselves. I think this is where it comes down to me is that there are some kinds of things, you know that thing about a pigeon versus a Creole? It's like the first generation of people get together from a bunch of countries. Everyone winds up in Hawaii, and you have people from the Philippines and Indonesia and China and Japan and so forth. And they're all together, and they develop a way of talking to each other. And that's a pigeon, but they don't speak it natively. It's just a convenience. Their children grow up, and they speak it natively, and that's a Creole. That becomes its own real language.
Is that an actual sort of way of defining these things? I'd never heard that before.
Yeah, I'm sure I'm doing a very coarse job of it, but that's kind of it. It's like, it's, you know, it's digital natives, right? It's like our generation didn't necessarily grow up as fully immersed in the current convention. So I'm still a visitor to social networks, even though I speak the language relatively fluently. It's not my mother tongue. It's not what I grew up speaking.
But your children treat it as like home.
Yeah. The first time I handed a digital camera to my kids, I don't know how old, maybe one of the kids was like one or something, because they'd already seen an iPhone, their immediate reaction was to swipe across the back of a digital camera. Yep. And I thought, holy cow, Apple's already rebuilt their brains. It's already wired them to a new native expectation. I didn't even know had happened because for me, I'm a content. We're all context switchers. You know, Anthony, you and I, and everybody of our generation who works in digital technology in any way, we are code switchers, and we have to be among all the different conventions that we have to use for different programs and systems and eras, and we can go back and forth in time. And the kids are natives.
Well, and that we've had to use through our lives as we've grown up with this, the development of this technology going on around us. You know, like you, I am old enough to remember a time before personal computers in the home. You know, I remember the first video games. I remember a life before computers and video games. And there's, you know, increasingly few of us that can actually say that. But we have had to develop, you know, our lives have gone alongside the development of this technology. And so we have had to develop and accommodate new ways of interacting with technology as it's been developing. And not to say that technology has stopped evolving by any means, just because we've reached touch screens. But clearly, we have had a certain amount of plateauing off, because the touch screen now, for a very long time, has remained the sort of apex of the computer revolution.
It requires a kind of, it's almost post-computer literacy something you hear about, because you don't need to troubleshoot, but you don't need to know how something works to make it do sophisticated things now. And in the past, it was often the case that if you couldn't dive into the guts to some extent, you couldn't get the job done, the task done, whatever it was.
It's like the argument about modern cars. You know, when I first started driving and owning cars, I could literally take the car apart, you know, disassemble the engine block to replace the head gasket, and then put it back in the car. Nowadays, quite apart from the fact that I'm pretty sure that would void any warranty that I had on the car, I'm not sure if it's even physically possible outside of a specialist construction, not construction plant, but, you know, a specialist sort of service area. Maybe it isn't even possible outside of the construction plant.
You need a bunch of computers, right,
they're so computerized, they're such a sort of black box. And it's the same thing with computers. Yeah, you know, they've become this black box of technology that just works, and how it works inside is increasingly less important to the people that use them.
Right. And so I'll pull this back to my pigeon Creole construction and the sort of, you know, so we're born into some kind of, you know, like one generation creates a new kind of music. A next generation is born listening to it and it's just what they hear. And yes. I think this applies in so many things. So difficult music has no generation to which it belongs is what I would say. So it never becomes a pervasive cultural construct so that having learned the convention at some point, you can listen to the whole genre. A classic moment is the Dragnet was a TV series, you know, that ran for many years in America. There was a Dragnet movie that predated it, I think, or was in the first season. And, it's great because Jack Webb is super, like later he kind of became this sort of, you know, fleshy, kind of older looking guy and kind of wandering around, you know, didn't seem more serious and like authority. This is when he was young and lean and looked like a tiger and everything was crisp and sharp and had a kind of implicit violence in him. It was a great, weird film, but this is a point where he's like, I've got a source. We got to go talk to this guy. And they're in a jazz club. And there's these four white guys in suits on stage, and they are playing the most anodyne possible jazz music. And Joe Friday looks at his partner like, oh, my God, look at these crazy, out-of-control musicians. And it's like, oh, right, that was nuts at the time. You know, that was way out there at that time.
Bill Haley.
So, yeah, exactly. Well, they're just going boom, 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 boom. I mean, it's just the most. So, or the moment in Back to the Future when he says, hey, Chuck, that new sound you've been looking for. There's that kind of thing. You know, there's these cultural moments when things shift. But I think then you have a sound that people are familiar with. And then that is just the sound of an era. And there may be 20 or 50 sounds of an era that different people, you know, heavy metal and certain kinds of jazz, or when we went from fusion, jazz fusion became a big thing for a while and still persists. And now we can have all these different genres that coexist. People are actively making music in so many of them, but all the conventions are understood. So you get introduced to it and the entire genre effectively opens up to you. And I want to say difficult music in contrast is something that it never has native speakers. It's always trying to talk to you in a new way. It's always trying to evoke that response. And there's always something when you come back to it that causes you to have to work again, even when you've become familiar with it. I mean, Laurie Anderson is a great example because I think in many ways she is one of the most popular culture-ish mainstream practitioners of, you know, we're calling it avant-garde, even though the avant was 1920, right? it's still avant-garde. She's still out in front. And she's done some mainstream things. I was just listening to the collaboration she did with Peter Gabriel. What was it called? It's Beautiful Birds or Excellent
this
Birds.
This is the
something
picture,
like
Excellent Birds. Yes.
Yeah, and it's wonderful, and it's relatively easy to listen to. But then you go back to some of her older stuff. I mean, she has such a range of things that are approachable and difficult. Some of it is her use of instrumentation, using her head as a percussion instrument by miking.
The drum suit.
Yeah, the drum suit, the piano tie, like she had so many things that were trying to turn her body or turn aspects of her clothing into instrumentation. And she's a real storyteller, so you can get the story through it. But it's still, you expose people to Laurie Anderson and they're like, whoa, and you take something from one era of her music and another, and people still have to kind of back off and go, okay, wait, now I thought I understood, you know, I've listened to O Superman, but what is this Sharky's Night business going on now, right?
Yes, and there is, I love that about artists who sort of, you know, change and evolve over time. And one of the things that I see on the slightly more commercial end of this, with things like, say, mid-90s ambient, one of my favorite bands from that era is a band called Autechre, which is two guys from the northwest of England, actually, not far from here. And their first stuff was very much in the tradition of mainstream ambience, you know, almost like Eno's discrete music pieces. It had rhythm and it had a bit of melody, but it was long drawn out instrumental pieces, synthesized sounds, etc., etc. And then as they went on, they clearly just kept trying to sort of one-up themselves. And you got to the point where some of their later albums are, I'm sure I remember one of them even coming with a sticker on it saying, this album contains no repetitive rhythms. You get to the point where that's a badge of honor, you know, where you've gone so far that along this road that you're actually advertising an album to, you know, to people, and, you know, these guys sell a lot of records within this scene. Yeah, to people saying, like, you should listen to this one because it's got no rhythm whatsoever that you can, and it's got plenty of percussion. This is another example of percussion versus rhythm that I was talking about earlier. Those albums have loads of percussive sounds, but there is no rhythm that you can sort of, you know, hang your hat on and really get into a groove with. And I always found it really interesting that they've actually started in their recent albums to come back round again. Maybe they feel that they've taken that about as far as it can go. But I always find that really interesting when artists are so, not that they're dissatisfied, but that they're so, they're dissatisfied with repeating themselves. They're so desperate not to repeat themselves that they drive themselves out further and further to the extremes of the kind of music they make.
And they have to bring an audience with them if they care about that. And some don't care and some do. I mean, some are trying to do something commercially or bring, you know, to be successful within whatever realm it was. Stephen Reich, I heard him talk once, and famously he was commissioned, I think this was the late 60s, to do a piece for, that was part of a subscription series, of a symphony orchestra. And when they performed his piece, people literally, some of the members of the subscription, you know, subscriber holders, ticket holders came up and like were banging on the stage. They were so angry at the music.
Wow.
And that's an incredible thing to be able to do, to cause people to become so angry that they respond viscerally. I went to a dance performance several years ago with my wife and a friend. It was part of a series, and friend's wife couldn't come, so we all went, and it had a lot of dancers running around on stage. They had all this high toned stuff, and at the end, like, people actually, it was again a subscription series, so a lot of people were season ticket holders. People walking out in the middle of this performance, they were so mad. And I was sort of furious by it at the end, because I thought it was kind of, in some ways, very beautifully. I mean, the dancers were extremely athletic and great performers, and the whole thing was constructed fantastically. But I left feeling mad about the whole thing. And then I was like, oh, wait, this is magnificent. They made me feel like I don't want to go see them again. But they achieved, and I don't know if they were trying to make me angry, but they made, you know, part of the thing, the theme of the dance was essentially like, we're all gonna die. It's like, yeah, I already know that. I mean, okay, you don't have to tell me that in these very boring ways. But at some level, maybe the reaction of me being so angry about it, it wasn't angry at the I was angry at some of the banality of it, but it was maybe they achieved something.
Maybe that was intentional.
Anyway.
Yeah,
I wasn't bored. I wasn't sitting there going, "Eh, this is dull." I was going like, "Oh my god, I'm so
Which it's is the worst thing for, you know, for any serious artist, whether you're on the commercial end of the spectrum or whether you're Karlheinz Stockhausen. You know, the last thing you want is for an audience to be bored. You know, whether you might want them to love you, you may want them to hate you, you may want them to do both, but you don't want them to sit there going, God, is this over yet?
I'll bring up, there's actually a very funny, it's almost a parody of Difficult Music, but not exactly. It's a great thing. It's from 20 years ago by these two they're Russian artists who got into some trouble in the late Soviet period because they were more like parodists, and they did very interesting stuff. So it's Vitaly Komar and Alexander Melamed, and they're the ones who, you may remember, they did these polls. They did scientific art, and they did a poll to figure out what the best and worst painting would be. And they got all the elements people wanted in each kind and then produced beautiful works of art that corresponded to these elements.
Oh, wow.
Their book is called Painting by Numbers, but there's this amazing thing in the Hudson School of, you know, it's a landscape, it's wide, not tall. It has George Washington in it because people like historical figures. So it's very funny. So the thing they did, and I was very much in a difficult music phase, so this totally cracked me up. They came out with the most wanted song and the most unwanted song based on polls. So the most wanted song is, I think it's sung in a crooner style, and it's very short, and it's very poppy, and it's sort of completely forgettable. The most unwanted song is 22 minutes long. It has bagpipes, rap music, accordion, cowboy music, tubas, and advertising jingles, and a children's choir or chorus in the middle. And the children's chorus, and because people hate music about holidays, and they hate commercialism, and they hate children's choirs. It was just like the lowest ranked things. So the kids at one point say, like, have this repetitive thing, Christmas time, do all your shopping at Walmart, is like just in the middle of the song. And the opera singer is going, oh, give me a home, you know, doing this cowboy little yodeling. And it's so funny. And it's so perfect how they combined least liked elements into something that was created in its, not seriously, but created in a way that was actually enjoyable to listen to. But it was like, I mean, just the things, the bottom of the barrel stuff all in one place. It's kind of incredible.
Wow. Just going back to sort of what we're talking about with historical stuff and, you know, the generational factors, people getting angry, banging on the stage, walking out, that sort of thing. What makes me think of, remember the Rite of Spring, those yes. stories about when the Rite of Spring was first performed in Paris,
people
there was practically
so
a riot. And we listen, now it's, you know, it's
like,
a standard classical piece of music that you will hear on late night, easy listening radio. It's ridiculous.
Don't make me think, right?
That was only in the earlier 20th century, so we're only talking, I mean, okay, a couple of world wars, but nevertheless, you're only talking 50 years between that and stuff like Stockhausen's Mikrofoni Ein and some of Steve Reich's early work. It's, and yet, you know, the difference between them in extremes of what's considered difficult music couldn't be further apart. It's incredible.
It's an amazing point to make. And I think it comes back to that. It's that cognitive dissonance. So, you know, the famous definition of kitsch of, was it Bernard, Greenberg, Clement Greenberg wrote that essay decades and decades ago. Was that in the 1940s also? But it was, you know, what's the difference between art and kitsch? And part of it is this predigestibility, is that kitsch does not challenge in any way.
Right.
Kitsch fits entirely within, we could say, all the constructs that already exist in someone's appreciation of the world around them. And by not challenging, it allows them the comfort of believing they are looking at art, examining, listening to it, without any of the benefits or you know, expectations.
Or indeed drawbacks.
Yeah, exactly, right. And difficult music is the, you know, I don't think there's a specific term like kitsch for difficult music or difficult art. I mean, I'm a great student of art history and think about from, I mean, every change of style. What's hilarious is, as you bring up Stravinsky too, is you can go back to almost any period of time after, I don't know, maybe like start in the 1700s, let's say, but you look at like styles in France and how people were so aggravated when, you know, someone starts a super realistic style and it starts sweeping the salons and everyone's like, oh my God, this will destroy art as we know it. Or then you have, the expressionists and you have the surrealists and the dadaists and then wave, and then you have, abstract expressionism, like wave after wave, like every 10 to 20 years, you start to have this accelerating wave of something that completely breaks the structure of the way in which visual art is presented and interpreted. And you get to the conceptual artists in which there is practice. There's nothing there. You know, it's the same time you have John Cage doing the 4 minutes, 33 seconds. And you have people like John Zorn and other people coming on the scene not long after that. This time in which, I mean, we bring up World Wars. Like, there is a notion that First World War destroyed art in that it made, you know, what is art in an age in which there is no meaning in the world? The Second World War.
Right. And it brought the rise of surrealism and Dadaism and the Bauhaus. And yeah, they all followed the First World War, I believe, didn't they?
Fascism, the rise of fascism and communism come from the same sources, in the sense that you have a the world has been destroyed, and how do we remake it? And everyone, in some of the ways, are good and bad. Democracy somehow was not the, that was after World War II. The idea of democracy, perhaps being a
least worst
a useful
and all
power.
That, you know.
Exactly. Right. Democratic capitalism. Well, let's find the thing that doesn't break the world again, if we can, maybe. But I think the music fits into that. I think music actually cycles somewhat slower than visual art. Visual art has a much higher degree of, like, completely breaking any notions that the previous generation had. And you come to this point where, when, if the art, whether it's music or visual art, if it is merely a blank canvas, what comes next? Like, how do, what is the next thing after a blank canvas? And I think we're still grappling with that decades after conceptual art came to existence.
Well, I was going to ask you about that, about music. But before we do, it's just occurred to me that I haven't asked you, and you haven't offered, how did you actually get into difficult music in the first place? What was your, because as I said, my first experience of what we could, you know, loosely call difficult music was Oh Superman being on the radio. What about you? Where did you first encounter it?
That is an excellent question, because as I recall it, I know by my early 20s, I was fascinated with it. And I was, even in college, I was buying Laurie Anderson. Laurie Anderson had this multi-album box set. I was visiting a friend and they had it used at a record store. Kids, there were these things called record stores, and they had big vinyl things in them. And I bought it because it was half or more.
So what was it, a set of like Big Science and Bright Red and all that sort of stuff?
I think it might have been, it was a box set. I want to say, it might have been, it wasn't our Brooklyn Academy of Music performances, but it had like four LPs in it, and this must have been 1989 or so whatever her box set was then, but I had already had Big Science before then. It may be Laurie Anderson was my gateway drug too. I'm sure I was aware of Philip Glass. I didn't hang out with minimalists in college. I didn't know that many musicians, but not long, you know, by the time I graduated in, this was 1990, I was already a big fan. So I must have been, I got, you know, exposed to They Might Be Giants in college and remain a fan. And I must have been exposed by, there must have been, I did work with, we had, at the time there was we had a bunch of college newspapers, and one of them was called Nadine, and it was a music newspaper. It was kind of a tabloid format, came out every month or so, and it was called The Magazine That Wishes It Was a Band. And it was all sorts of musicians. It's the greatest thing.
I think that's anybody, pretty much, I mean, every college magazine, isn't it?
Oh my gosh, this was great. But it was music only, and it was like, that was the thing. And I think that helped. So I knew some of the people involved. In fact, one of them, he reintroduced himself on Twitter a couple years ago. I'm like, oh my God, you know, I haven't talked to him in 30 years. But I think that helped introduce me to music that was outside of my ken, and some of those people, I would hear some of what they were playing. But I had already become, I can tell you, actually, the direct thing is, I had become a fan of Brecht and Weill before I went off to college. I'd heard, this is the origin story, I have it now, is that I heard Nina Simone singing the Pirate Jenny song on some local radio station, and it completely drove me berserk. I was like, this is the most amazing thing ever. So I tracked down Nina Simone in one direction. I tracked down so I became a huge Nina Simone fan.
In the other direction.
Yeah, and then that led me to Kate Bush, because Kate Bush has a wonderful, creepy version of the Pirate Jenny song. And the Pirate Jenny song is itself a very interesting piece of music that is subversive to play on radio, because it sounds like it's something it's not in the context of the play. It's more complicated. But that got me into listening to this, you know, German expressionist era music, basically. And then from there into, you know, more of the modern forms. I think that made me receptive to something like Laurie Anderson. Stephen Reich came later, but boy, do I love Stephen Reich too.
Yeah. So, okay. So as a segue into talking about the future, then, just briefly, you said about how it's kind of difficult music is still difficult. It's not like it was difficult and now we got over it, you know, like Bill Haley or rock and roll or Elvis or whatever, you know, or even, I don't know, Revolution 9, you know, we got over those and now they're considered a part of regular music. But that's not the case with a lot of this difficult music. And a perfect example of that, before the show, I sort of, you know, revisited a few works. And things like on YouTube, I mean, it's YouTube, so you have to make some allowances, but nevertheless, you go to some of Stockhouse's mm-hmm. performances, videos of which are on YouTube, of Microphony Iron and Mixture and things like that, or even, you know, brief performances of Hans Werner Henze's Der Langwierige, stuff like that.
And oh, yes.
See the comments, and clearly this music still absolutely baffles, confuses, and outright angers many, many people who are just like, well, this is just random noise. These people are charlatans. What the hell's going on? So they haven't lost their ability to shock and anger people, which I think is wonderful, considering how old some of these pieces are.
Some of the music could be 50 to 100 years old, and it's still, I mean, the stuff you're citing is you know, mostly 1960s, right? The, Der Langwierige Weg in der Wohnung der Natascha Ungeheuer is definitely.
Well done. See, I wasn't going to attempt to say the whole title.
It's, Hans Werner Henze. This is one of the, it's a great, premiered 1971. And it's got, I have the album someplace, unless I got rid of all my LPs, but I loved listening to it because it had, there's a baritone soloist, it had an organist, a jazz band, and a chamber ensemble, and then percussion and tape, music on tape, and somehow this glorious mess, all hung together. But you'd have, you know, the classical sound of a chamber ensemble playing against a jazz band. They're almost in competition. They're fighting on stage practically as they played. It's nothing about it lends itself to interpretation. You have to create the interpretation yourself. And I think that's the defining characteristic. You need somebody to walk you through it. You know, more modern terms, do you know Tune Yards? This is Meryl Garbus is the performer's name.
No.
She's, I don't want to say like a not obscure. I have not heard a lot of her work. She is the whitest of white girls. She went to Smith College. And when you hear her, you assume she is some kind of Afro-Caribbean performer. And she's not, it's not a put on. She has this whole, I mean, she's not performing in blackface for God's sake, but she absorbed this entire approach to, music that you cannot identify with any, like, you know, Western white music tradition, classical traditions. It's something entirely that comes out of black cultures and more like the Caribbean. And it doesn't feel like a put on. And she's accepted, you know, the community that she works with. She's not seen as somebody who's an appropriator because she created something new, but it is difficult and complicated. And she uses tape loops, drum loops on the spot. She's creating them. And she does vocoder work. So, she's been performing now for a number of years like this. She's not new. It's several years of this under her belt, but, she's somebody I would say is the youngest, best known performer, I think, trying in the broadest way to be able to create difficult music in the contemporary time. I think a lot of other musicians are out there doing it. And they're all along the sides. They've been sidelined by the massive amount of choice we have for music now.
Right.
Musician friend of mine noted the great problem musicians have today who are working musicians creating new music is that the entire history of all music is available essentially at no cost.
A click away. Yeah.
Yeah. And I was like, oh my God, I never thought about that as such a disabling thing, that why would someone buy something new when there's a billion pieces or, you know, 100 million pieces of music that's available essentially for one subscription price or at very low cost or free on YouTube.
And pieces that everybody else keeps telling them are the classics.
Yeah. So go listen to this 500 hours of music before you try a new musician. Yeah. I mean, attention's already scarce, then you have that. But there are still people out there pushing at the limits and getting, you know, you can't define, like, difficult music can be extremely niche. It could be somebody doing something with 10 people in, you know, Berlin basement, right? Rotzkeller. But I think there's almost definitionally the music that fits the thing I'm talking about. It's become popular in the sense that people discuss it. It becomes the object of discussion. It's not that millions of people are listening to it, but that there is, it's part of a, becomes part of the theme of what is discussed about music of that time. So that it's something that many people can listen to and have opinions about. So it's very difficult. People doing things that are so extreme, they have no, listeners at all then, or very few. I mean, that's the YouTube phenomenon too. You could have 10 people subscribe to your channel, not a million. So I think it has to become part of the discourse to really have an effect, because it then influences people downstream in the future.
Absolutely. And I mean, the future is something that, you know, we need to look towards. I mean, like you say, this stuff doesn't really age. And It's interesting. Exactly. It's interesting to note that a lot of difficult composers, or composers of difficult music, like Steve Reich and John Zorn and Laurie Anderson and Stockhausen, you know, to a greater or lesser extent, have been massively influential then on people like Brian Eno and 90s ambient techno groups that are on Warp Records that I listen to, and, you know, all that sort of stuff. And here's a brilliant thing that you probably, are you familiar with the fairly recent, I would say, you know, probably started maybe 5 or 6 years ago, this thing where people would take a piece of popular, well-known music and slow it down. It was when time stretching technology became amazing. They'd slow it down like 1,000% to make a 50-minute piece out of a 2-minute Justin Bieber song.
I've heard some of that, and it's extraordinary. It's so strange.
But here's the great thing. I have discovered there are people now doing that with Steve Reich pieces.
Oh, my goodness.
That isn't that wonderful?
Is irony.
When I saw that, I was like, oh, wow. Oh, this is just the beauty and the irony and the sort of the generational shift. I just love it. I absolutely love that somebody is doing that with these, you know, pieces that arguably, without which you may not have, you know, this whole genre of soft ambient, which in turn inevitably influenced bands like Sigur Rós and then led to people trying out this time stretching phenomenon to create similar ambient sounds. It's just the whole thing is just brilliant. So tied up. I love it. It's like the snake eating its own tail. You know, it's the Ouroboros of difficult music.
I want to loop back to for 1 second, speaking of tape loops, is Pet Sounds is probably the, like, there's an inflection point there where that is, you know, hailed as one of the most amazing albums ever released, right? Mm-hmm. It's, it hit, it had commercial success. It sort of changed, what could be expected from pop music. And yet it was, in many ways, comes out of the same avant-garde tradition that, Hans Werner Henze was engaged with, and using loops and repeated sounds and found sounds and complex, but somehow, Brian Wilson created something that was approachable, but very difficult.
Well,
but
and it's contemporary.
Trusted him.
It's contemporary with people like Reich and Stockhausen as well. Pet Sounds is working, what, 65, 66?
It's 60, released in 66, so he was making it that's amazing, actually. They made it that year and then released it. That's incredible. They made it in 4 months and then they put it out. It's like, how do you do that? Holy cow.
Well, everybody does that now, but back then, quite difficult.
Yeah, he's using, you're right. He is contemporary with him. And I have to believe, there's a simultaneous evolution, or there's the response to, and I have to believe he was hearing, even in the middle of being this pop star, was hearing this other kind of music, and it either challenged him, or the milieu was so extraordinary at that time, he just absorbed it the same way other people were, because in some ways,
like a pervasive zeitgeist.
Yeah, exactly. And which is incredible when you think about, though, that you have people are performing stuff that's making people scream and bang on the stage. Very similar elements are in an album that is released by one of the largest, you know, the most popular groups of all time, that becomes an incredibly popular, consumerly, commercially successful album. That is a fascinating thing to me.
It is amazing. All right, Glenn, we're going to have to wrap it up. Otherwise,
we're not going to make this difficult to listen to. That's right.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. We don't want to, otherwise it'll be 4 hours long ourselves. But it has been wonderful chatting to you, about this. And yeah, I love this. And I hope we have persuaded some people at least to, you know, give this stuff a try. And yeah, it's not easy to listen to, that's kind of the point, but it will make you think. It will make you, especially if you have an interest in music and sounds and art, it will give you something to think about, and that surely is, you know, worthwhile.
That's right.
So Glenn, where can people find you if they like what you have to say?
Well, they can find me. I have a thing called a blog that's at glog, G-L-O-G, dot glennf, G-L-E-N-N-F, dot com, or on Twitter at G-L-E-N-N-F, where I tweet too much, but you can find me there.
People still have blogs?
I know. It's a weird thing. I actually update it from time to time, too. It's the strangest thing.
You strange person.
I'm not a weirdo. I know.
Thanks for listening to Unjustly Maligned. You can check out my comics, books, and music at anthonyjohnston.com, where you'll find information and links to all of my work. You can support Unjustly Maligned by becoming a member of the Incomparable Network. Go to theincomparable.com/members to sign up, and check the box for Unjustly Maligned when you choose which shows to support. You can also help by reviewing Unjustly Maligned on iTunes and following us on Twitter at UMPFM. Finally, the show notes for this episode are at ump.fm. Unjustly Maligned is a 7RQ production for The Incomparable and is made in England. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time. I often say in comics that the greatest danger for any comic creator is not piracy, it's obscurity. It's exactly the same problem.
Oh my gosh. Well, in an era of very, very split attention, people, yes, paying attention to you is very important, even if they write critically about it and hate what you do. That may actually attract more people who are like, oh, that person who's writing about what's awful, perhaps that is the thing I like.
I saw a weird thing. I can't remember where now, but I saw a weird thing that suggested that even negative reviews on Amazon make people more inclined to buy a book.
This is true. There's been some studies where they've analyzed similar books, and I don't know if Amazon's in the A/B testing themselves. They may have, but where they suppress and show reviews. But there's something about a book that has no reviews or few reviews means people are like, huh, nobody's reading it, nobody cares about it. A book that has a lot of reviews, even if they're, or many, you know, certain, I think there's a threshold of like some dozens, right? Even if they're negative, people will read it and they'll go, oh, well, maybe I don't agree with that, or oh, that's interesting, or oh, you know, actually, I kind of like that. But it gives them more to chew on as it being a book that gives them more security that other people are also engaged in it, I think.
But ties in, actually, thinking about it, to what we were talking about the sort of wanting a reaction. About, you know, the worst thing for an audience is to be bored. And so maybe maybe we recognize that. Talking about things going around in cycles as well, you mentioned about how sort of the differences in scales between East and West, for example, and even the mm-hmm. Middle East, you know, the different chromatic scales and tones. But here's an interesting thing. The shamisen, that's the Japanese three-stringed, almost like banjo-like instrument.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
That is experiencing a revival now in Japan. You know, there are young Japanese musicians who are actively using it and learning to play it because it's, you know, it is not the same as playing a guitar. Very, very different. But they're actively seeking out, you know, ways to use it and making recordings with it. I assume as some kind of, you know, retro backlash to its, you know, almost complete elimination from popular culture. Oh. I don't know. It's but
that's,
it's fascinating.
Cool. I think, I mean, the ukulele is a weird example there too. Like, I mean, it was an exotic instrument at one point. It wasn't, you know, a classical American instrument, but then it's the fact that people, I mean, it's easy to make one as part of it. You can make a cheap ukulele out of a milk carton, basically, or something.
It's also small and very easy to carry around.
Yeah, people have fun with it. I just love the fact that it's like, you know, I feel like amateur music, we talked about this. I mean, the Kurt Vonnegut had that essay about amateurism many years ago. I meant to dig it up at some point, but it's that, I think the professionalism of, art, like performing art is a modern phenomenon. There's actually a period of time right. in which mass media destroyed people's desire to create, you know, especially music themselves. And I think YouTube has been such an enabler of getting people to do, to perform again. And the ukulele, like all these things, like people are actually, you know, get together and do music. They do crafts. They got, you know, the knitting movement is astonishing. I'm like, oh,
yep.
It's kind of this rediscovery of what people did for essentially ever since tools of any kind were developed until like 1930. And then it's like, oh, okay, we'll have a little hiatus and then we'll come back to, people making, his statement was something like, it used to be that you get together at a family gathering and so-and-so played the accordion. He was the best person to play the accordion in town. He'd jump up on the table and you'd all have a great time. Then you could just turn on the radio and hear the best accordion player in the world. So whatever, right?
Have you heard of Aphex Twin?
I do not believe I have.
Aphex Twin is a British musician called Richard James, real name, who didn't quite invent sort of, you know, ambient techno over here, but he was definitely a pioneer of it. And, you know, certainly has been credited with both popularizing some aspects of it and inventing some of the more difficult aspects of it. Like there's a wonderful apocryphal story of him getting booked to do a DJ slot at some club. And he took a piece of sandpaper, dropped the needle, put the sandpaper on the turntable, dropped the needle on it and let it play for like 30 minutes.
Oh my God.
I'm sure that's not actually true, but it's the sort of thing you could imagine him doing, you know?
I'm just found his page here. I'll have to look him up.
But he has, there's one particular track on, I think his third album called Ventolin. Ventolin, over here anyway, is the brand name of the asthma inhaler medicine.
I think my son takes that.
Right. And it's a really difficult track to listen to. And it has a sort of, you know, some kind of a melody, but it also has this incessant, and I do mean incessant, really piercing, high-pitched whine running throughout the entire song for like 5 minutes or whatever of the song, which makes it, just adding that on immediately makes it really difficult to listen to. But I love it because I always figured, because he suffers from asthma himself, and I always figured that it was him trying to make a sort of aural representation, expression of what it's like to have an asthma attack, you know?
Oh, interesting.
I think you'd like him anyway, but you should definitely seek out that particular track because I think it's one of the few of his that really fits into the milieu of what we were talking about here.
He's got, I'm making notes. The I'm found a record cover that has a looking extremely disturbing face.
Oh, yes, there are many of them like that. Yes, it's kind of his thing.